VOA.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from John Russell, Jill Robbins, and Brian Lynn. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is John Russell.
With bright lights on the floor and walls, loud electronic music, and a red shuttlecock flying around, this Malaysian badminton court seems like the set of a science fiction movie. Shuttle in the Dark is a place to play badminton in the famous Petronas Twin Towers in Kuala Lumpur. It was set up in late 2021 by a company that wanted people to take up the sport after 2 years of restrictions related to the COVID-19 pandemic. Badminton is one of the most popular sports in Malaysia and Asia. The Southeast Asian country has produced some of the world's top-ranked players. Irina Inozametseva is director of Inix Sport Management. She said the goal was to gain back the interest of people to come back and play. She added that the group wanted to draw in not only expert players, but also new people who were not able to or never played badminton before. The futuristic court presents a new difficulty for players. They have to adjust their eyes to the darkness to play, said Li Yan Sheng, a professional badminton coach. Professional player Ho Yan Mei used the term focus, meaning to carefully direct attention, to describe the requirements of playing on the court. With the lighting, somehow we are still able to hit it, and then it requires better focus. And it's exciting. It's different, but it's still like playing normal badminton, she said. Open to players of all levels, Shuttle in the Dark charges $42.63 per hour to use the courts and rent their equipment. A regular public court charges about $4.50. I'm John Russell.
They began with funny videos and talked over Mario Kart racing games on their YouTube channel. Now, two Ukrainian brothers who live in Japan have added a more serious subject to their videos. They are telling young Japanese about the news from their country and bringing the realities of war closer to Japan. Just before the Russian invasion of Ukraine began, Sava Takakov, 26, and his younger brother, Jan, 20, celebrated the second anniversary of opening their YouTube broadcast. Now, over 2 million people follow their Sawayan channel and the Sawayan Games channel that Sava hosts. The first word of war came from their father. He is a business person and had returned to Kyiv 2 months ago. After Russian troops arrived, he stayed to help defend his country. The brothers' YouTube content, which used to be full of tricks, jokes, and action videos, has become more serious. They worried about their 53-year-old father and friends in Ukraine. In early March, the brothers said that they planned to volunteer as defenders too. It started a wave of reactions, some supporting and others criticizing them. The father said they should not come. The Tkachos have no military training and soon changed their minds. Sava said he received long and serious messages from some of his teenage fans showing they wanted to follow the brothers to Ukraine. By sending out messages through our channel, I made kids want to go to war, and I cannot say if it was good or bad, Sava said at a news conference Thursday. But at least it was meaningful that they became interested in the issue. Sava, who uses the social media name No War, used his gaming channel to raise money. He collected some 3.6 million yen, or $29,500, in 3 hours and donated all of it to the Ukrainian embassy. Jan and Sava said they also started receiving messages from parents saying their children started thinking about peace. Others thanked them for raising important social issues. I believe the merit of YouTube is I can convey the real information from the ground that my father is sharing with us about the situation that is very up to date. He puts it on the internet almost immediately, Sava said. Japan was quick to join other industrialized nations in placing restrictions on trade with Russia and providing support for Ukraine. Tokyo has also sent some military equipment, but not weapons, and medical supplies to Ukraine. It is an exception to Japan's ban on sending military equipment to countries in conflict. Japan's government is worried about the effect of Moscow's war on East Asia. Tokyo has faced recent threats from North Korea and China. Due to sanctions, Russia stopped peace treaty talks with Japan over the disputed Kuril Islands. Moscow has held the island chain north of Japan since 1945. Sava Takachov arrived with his family in Japan when he was 4 and studied at a top Japanese university. He thanked his adopted country for its support, but said Tokyo should keep its peaceful role in world affairs. Japan is the world's top-class peaceful nation, and what the country is doing right now is very appropriate, he said. As to the question of whether Japan should send weapons, I do not think it's the kind of role Japan should be playing. Instead, he said, Japan can better help by continuing to appeal for peace and take a leadership role within Asia. He also said Japan can provide home to many Ukrainian refugees. Some may find the language difficult or the food unusual, but I'm sure they can overcome the difficulties with the empathy of the Japanese people and the spirits of the Ukrainians. I'm Jill Robbins.
The American Space Agency, NASA, is carrying out final testing on its new rocket that aims to help return humans to the moon. NASA says its Space Launch System, or SLS, is the most powerful rocket ever built. U.S. officials have said the rocket was designed to begin a new generation of human space exploration. SLS is the first rocket designed to carry both astronauts and supplies on a single mission. It is part of NASA's Artemis program, which aims to land the first woman and first person of color on the moon. Artemis has a goal to land American astronauts on the moon no earlier than 2025. Last year, NASA pushed back the planned launch. It would be the first moon landing by astronauts since NASA's Apollo 17 mission in 1972. NASA is calling the first launch of the SLS rocket Artemis 1. There will be no crew on the spacecraft during the first mission. SLS will carry NASA's Orion spacecraft on a test mission to fly around the moon. NASA announced last year that it had chosen American company SpaceX as its partner to land the next astronauts on the moon. SpaceX has already completed several missions to carry astronauts to the International Space Station. SpaceX uses the Falcon 9 rocket and Crew Dragon spacecraft. SpaceX also is developing and testing a human landing system, HLS, designed to put humans on the moon. NASA's plan for the future calls for its SLS rocket to transport astronauts on the Orion spacecraft to lunar orbit. From there, astronauts would transfer to SpaceX's HLS to be transported to the surface of the moon. SpaceX has also developed a super heavy space vehicle called Starship. Company chief Elon Musk has said Starship is designed to transport astronauts to the moon as well as possibly Mars. Unlike the SLS rocket, Starship is designed to be reusable. SpaceX plans to carry out a test flight to launch Starship into orbit sometime this year. In addition to Starship, NASA announced earlier this month that it is seeking additional proposals from American companies to develop moon landers. The landers are to transport astronauts between lunar orbit and the moon's surface. NASA said landers should have the ability to link up with a future lunar orbiting space station it plans to create called Gateway. In preparation for its upcoming flight, SLS was recently transported to a launch structure in Cape Canaveral, Florida, for final testing operations. One of the next major tests for the system is called a wet dress rehearsal. This preparation will involve engineers fully loading the rocket's main fuel tanks with liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen. Then a simulated launch countdown will take place. The countdown will stop seconds before the rocket's four RS-25 engines start. All other systems are to be fully examined and tested in the coming weeks. Information from the tests will help decide when the rocket will be launched. During the test mission, Orion will aim to travel 450,600 kilometers from Earth and thousands of kilometers beyond the moon. NASA said This will be farther than any spacecraft built for humans has ever traveled. The mission is expected to last 4 to 6 weeks. I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. On a cold October day in 1957, the Soviet Union launched a small satellite into orbit around the Earth. Radio Moscow made the announcement.
The first artificial Earth satellite in the world has now been created. This first satellite was today successfully launched in the USSR.
The world's first satellite was called Sputnik 1. Sputnik was an important propaganda victory for the Soviets in the Cold War with the United States. Many people believed the nation that controlled space could win any war, and the Soviet Union had reached outer space first. The technology that launched Sputnik probably began in the late 19th century. A Russian teacher of that time, Konstantin Tsiolkovsky, decided that a rocket engine could provide power for a space vehicle. In the early 1900s, another teacher, American Robert Goddard, tested the idea. He experimented with small rockets to see how high and how far they could travel. In 1923, a Romanian student in Germany, Hermann Oberth, showed how a spaceship might be built and launched to other planets. Rocket technology improved during World War II. It was used to produce flying bombs. Thousands of people in Britain and Belgium died as a result of V-1 and V-2 rocket attacks. The rockets were launched from Germany. The larger V-2 rocket had the ability to hit the United States. After the war, it became clear that the United States and the Soviet Union, allies in wartime, would become enemies in peacetime. So both countries employed German scientists to help them win the race to space. The Soviets took the first step by creating Sputnik. This satellite was about the size of a basketball. It got its power from a rocket. It orbited Earth for 3 months. Within weeks, the Soviets launched another satellite into Earth orbit, Sputnik 2. It was much bigger and heavier than Sputnik 1. It also carried a passenger, a dog named Laika. The United States joined the space race about 3 months later. It launched a satellite from Cape Canaveral in the southeastern state of Florida. The satellite was called Explorer 1. It weighed about 14 kilograms. Explorer 1 went into a higher orbit than either Sputnik, and its instruments made an important discovery. They found an area of radiation about 960 kilometers above Earth. The next major space victory belonged to the Soviets. They sent the first man into space. In April 1961, cosmonaut Yuri Gagarin was launched in the vehicle known as Vostok. He remained in space for less than 2 hours. He landed safely by parachute near a village in Russia. Less than a month later, the United States sent its first astronaut into space. He was Alan Shepard. Shepard remained in space only about 15 minutes. He did not go into Earth orbit. That flight came in February 1962 with John Glenn. By 1965, the United States and the Soviet Union were experimenting to see if humans could survive outside a spacecraft. In March, Russian cosmonaut Alexei Leonov became the first person to do so. A strong tether connected Leonov to the spacecraft. The tether gave him oxygen to breathe, and it permitted him to float freely at the other end. After about 10 minutes, Leonov had to return to the spacecraft. He said he regretted the decision. He was having such a good time. A little more than 2 months later, an American would walk outside his spacecraft. Astronaut Edward White had a kind of rocket gun. This gave him some control of his movements in space. Like Leonov, White was sorry when he had to return to his spacecraft. Later that year, 1965, the United States tried to have one spacecraft get very close to another spacecraft while in orbit. This was the first step in getting spacecraft to link or dock together. Docking would be necessary to land men on the moon. The plan called for a Gemini spacecraft carrying two astronauts to get close to an unmanned satellite. The attempt failed. The target satellite exploded as it separated from its main rocket. America's space agency decided to move forward. It would launch the next in its Gemini series. Then someone had an idea. Why not launch both Geminis? The second one could chase the first one instead of a satellite. Again, things did not go as planned. It took two tries to launch the second Gemini. By that time, the first one had been in orbit about 11 days. Time was running out. The astronauts on the second Gemini moved their spacecraft into higher orbits. They got closer and closer to the Gemini ahead of them. They needed to get within 600 meters to be considered successful. After all the problems on the ground, the events in space went smoothly. The two spacecraft got within one-third of a meter of each other. The astronauts had made the operation seem easy. In January 1959, the Soviets launched a series of unmanned lunar rockets. The third of these flights took pictures of the far side of the moon. This was the side no one on Earth had ever seen. The United States planned to explore the moon with its unmanned Ranger spacecraft. There were a number of failures before Ranger 7 took pictures of the moon. These pictures were made from a distance. The world did not get pictures from the surface of the moon until the Soviet Luna 9 landed there in February 1966. For the next few years, both the United States and the Soviet Union continued their exploration of the moon. Yet the question remained, which one would be the first to put a man there? In December 1968, the United States launched Apollo 8 with three astronauts. The flight proved that the spacecraft could orbit the moon and return to Earth safely. The Apollo 9 spacecraft had two vehicles. One was the command module. It could orbit the moon, but could not land on it. The other was the lunar module. On a flight to the moon, it would separate from the command module and land on the moon's surface. Apollo 10 astronauts unlinked the lunar module and flew it close to the moon's surface. After those flights, everything was ready.
12, 11, 10, 9, ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0, all engine running.
On July 16, 1969, three American astronauts lifted off in Apollo 11. On the 20th, Neil Armstrong and Edwin Aldrin entered the lunar module called the Eagle. Michael Collins remained in the command module, the Columbia. The two vehicles separated.
25 feet, that's looking good, down a half.
It was a dangerous time. The Eagle could crash, or it could fall over after it landed. That meant the astronauts would die on the moon.
Four forward, drifting to the right a little. 30 seconds forward.
Millions of people watched on television or listened on the radio. They waited for Armstrong's message.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
The Eagle has landed. Then they waited again. It took the astronauts more than 3 hours to complete the preparations needed to leave the lunar module. Finally, the door opened. Neil Armstrong climbed down first. He put one foot on the moon, then the other foot, and then came his words from so far away.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Man on the moon. Oh, boy. Boy.
Okay, we're going to be busy for a minute.
CBS television newsman Walter Cronkite shared the excitement that he and so many people felt as man first walked on the surface of the moon. Later, Cronkite would remember the historical significance of that moment in 1969.
It's hard, I think, to imagine our emotions at the moment. It really was something that had to grip you. It was as if you could have stood at the dock and waved goodbye to Columbus. You knew darn good and well that this was the real history in the making.
Armstrong walked around. Soon, Aldrin joined him.
They're setting up the flag now.
The two men placed an American flag on the surface of the moon. They also collected moon rocks and soil. When it was time to leave, they returned to the Eagle and guided it safely away. They reunited with the Columbia and headed for home. The United States had won the race to the moon.
The thing that made this one particularly gripping was that sense of history, that if this was successful, this was a date that was going to be in all of the history books from time evermore. I think we sensed that at the time, just sitting there at the Cape and watching that great beast get on its way, that this was it.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.